Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin in a moment to discuss tomorrow's State of the Union address with a White House insider who has studied the Obama presidency and the president close up and personal. Jonathan Alter, the author of The Promise, joins us. Then we'll look into who the perpetrators of the airport bombing in Moscow might be, as well as examine the murky nexus between former KGB officers, politicians, oligarchs, and warlords in post-Soviet Russia, since many believe previous bombings attributed to terrorists have state fingerprints on them. Kimberly Martin, professor of political science at Barnard College and a specialist on Russian internal security, joins us. And then we will talk with Jane Hampshire, the founder of FireDogLake.com, who was detained by MPs at the Quantico, Virginia base on her way to visit Bradley Manning, the Army private being held in solitary confinement in the brig, who is accused of supplying the trove of classified diplomatic and military cables to WikiLeaks. We have a lot to discuss, so stay tuned. Let us begin with a discussion of the state of the Obama presidency as the president prepares for his State of the Union address. I'm speaking with Jonathan Alter, who is a senior editor at Newsweek and an analyst for NBC News. He's the author of The Defining Moment, FDR's 100 Days and the Triumph of Hope, Between the Lines, A View Inside American Politics, People and Culture, and most recently, The Promise, President Obama, Year One, now out in paperback with a new epilogue. Thank you for joining us on Background Briefing, Jonathan Alter.
My pleasure.
And in your new epilogue, Jonathan Alter, you mentioned that back in early in 2007, the president meeting with his inner circle said, presidents only drive 20% of their agendas. The other 80% of the job is reactive. And that certainly has proven true in these past 2 years, given the legacy of the Bush era with a near-death experience with the economy and the environmental disaster in the Gulf and this millstone of unemployment hanging around his neck. How do you think he's going to turn that around, if indeed he hasn't begun to do that?
Well, I think he's begun to turn it around politically. He's risen a lot among independents, whom he had a huge problem with. If you remember, he won independents handily in 2008, and Democrats lost them overwhelmingly in 2010. And in recent weeks, he's gained a lot of ground back with them. He's up around in the low to mid-50s in the approval rating. So that's the good news for him. The not-so-good news is that his fate over the next couple of years politically really depends on bringing that unemployment rate down at least some from 9.5%. And I don't think anybody knows whether he's going to be successful at that. We're going to hear tomorrow night some of what he plans to do about it. My own sense is I'm just a little more comfortable trying to look at events that have already happened that I tried to provide the backstory for in The Promise than in making speculating about things that may or may not happen. As you know as well as I do, you know, the pundits are, myself included, are often wrong when we try to look into our crystal ball.
Well, one thing that history indicates is that presidents don't get reelected with anything over 7% unemployment. And he's got 9, close to 10, and it's, according to Bernanke, it's not going to go away for a couple of years.
I mean, these kinds of rules are made to be broken. I mean, Ronald Reagan was reelected overwhelmingly in 1984, despite unemployment that was, a little bit over 7%, but he hadn't, really gotten it down lower than that. So a lot of it, I think, depends on whether the public feels that events are moving in the right direction or not. I think if he can get unemployment down to around 8% and make people feel that things are, at least seeming to be headed in the right direction and he's got a record to run on, he'll be okay. If it's up around 9.5 or 10%, he's in real political trouble.
Again, I'm speaking with Jonathan Alter, the author of The Promise, President Obama, Year One, now out in paperback. But I'm curious, Jonathan Alter, why from day one he didn't make himself the jobs president, the guy that's been handed this terrible plate of disasters. And there was some talk earlier, I recall, where he even himself said, maybe I'll be a one-term president. And in a sense, to share his dilemma with the American public, because they're not mutually exclusive. He wants to be a successful president, and the way to get successful is to have the economy revive. He seems to be doing that now by shaking down the CEOs and saying, come on, get to work. Let's start exporting. Let's get jobs going. In other words, share his journey. This is the great communicator.
Well, the big surprise to me when I was working on The Promise was that we expected him to be somebody who aced communications, you know, got an A-plus because he'd been such a silver-tongued orator during the campaign, and that he would struggle in actually getting things done in executive management and leadership because he had no experience to speak of. And yet the reverse turned out to be the case. He struggled in communication. He had a lot of trouble framing a message, trouble selling what he was doing on health care, trouble pivoting to a jobs message. But if you look at the record, it's rather stunning. I mean, there was plenty of liberal criticism, you know, which I agreed with, that he didn't get a public option, and it would have been better to have a public option. But he was dealing in the real world where the votes weren't there for it, and he insured 30 million more Americans and ended discrimination against sick people, which we've had in this country for a long time. And this is the greatest piece of social legislation since the Great Society in the 1960s and Lyndon Johnson. And there was a lot of other legislation as well, but the consequence of that was that he wasn't able to develop the single-minded focus on jobs that the American people wanted, and he lost some of that connection, at least for a time, with the public. I think from their perspective, they felt like they had gotten through a $787 billion stimulus, which whatever Paul Krugman and some other critics might say was as much as the political system would absorb, and more public investment than in his first month in office than Bill Clinton, for instance, had in 8 years in office, and that he came back at the end of the year of 2010 with what in effect was a second stimulus, a stealth stimulus that he got through using tax policy to stimulate the economy by cutting taxes on working families, although he had to swallow a continued tax cut for the wealthy as the price for that. But so he, it's not like he hasn't been paying attention to trying to get the economy moving again, but he was first focused on preventing a depression, preventing things from getting a lot worse. If we'd stayed on the pace we were on in January of 2009 when he came into office, we were losing 750,000 jobs a month, and if we'd stayed on that pace, we would have been in another Great Depression, without exaggeration, by the end of the year. So the first thing he had to do was put a tourniquet on stop the bleeding. And so at least some of the promise is about how did they prevent a depression and, what kind of things did they do and not do. And so I think some people had expectations of him that were a little bit unrealistic, but you're quite right that he didn't tell a story and put it in the context of a narrative. And it's going to be interesting to see whether he does so tomorrow night.
And do you think in any way, Jonathan Alter, that it's fair for Rahm Emanuel to get some of the blame? I noticed today, of course, in your book, The Promise, in the epilogue of the new paperback edition, Jonathan Alter, you mentioned that Rahm Emanuel's ambition was always to be the first Jewish Speaker of the House, and his second choice was to be Mayor of Chicago, and the courts have apparently just taken that opportunity away, at least at this point. But you do mention that there was a dysfunction between Emanuel and Larry Summers and Axelrod that made the workings of the White House grind to a halt, if you will. I mean, everybody I talked to said that Summers wanted Geithner's job. He wanted Bernanke's job. He bullied everybody. He marginalized Volcker. I mean, the guy sounded like a one-man wrecking crew.
Well, Larry Summers is not thrilled by my book. I tell a lot of stories confirm what you just said. Screaming match between him and Christina Romer, the chairwoman of the Council of Economic Advisors, and his sharp elbows and keeping more liberal economists out of meetings, and this was, you know, part of the first year. But it's not a black and white story because, you know, some of what he suggested worked, and I think it's easy easy to just kind of dump it all on one person. But the story is a little more complicated. My overall critique of Summers' performance was that he kept the circle of advisors around the president too tight, and he did not push to use the leverage that Obama had when he had it. And they could have essentially dictated terms to the banks in 2009, and they didn't do so because Summers argued that they were too brittle and you know, not in a position to sustain that kind of pressure. I think he was wrong about that, but I think it's important to recognize that he was right in a lot of what he recommended that had the effect of preventing a depression. And if we hadn't made certain decisions, we would now be looking at 20% unemployment.
But so, Jonathan,
one of the things I try to do is paint a more complex picture, do less finger pointing and judging, and more telling people what actually happened, the backstory, what happened when that Oval Office door closed, because you don't hear about it on television and radio at the time. It's very, very hard to get. Mm-hmm. You have to go back later and do a lot of work with sources, as I did, to paint a true historic picture of what happened.
Well, part of the picture you've painted, Jonathan Alter, which I find fascinating, and I'm absolutely puzzled to why there's a consistency here. Al Gore effectively lost his presidency, even though arguably he won, and then conceded unnecessarily. He lost because he didn't go to the big dog, Clinton's help. He distanced himself and put Joe Lieberman on the ticket. And I read in your book, The Promise, that even the Obama's National Security Council and his staffers also tried to distance Obama from the big dog, who turned out to be very helpful. He made a deal with Putin when he happened to be with Putin when the spy thing happened, and he managed to make a deal that kept that thing from becoming a big deal. He also got the two women, actually Al Gore's women, out of North Korea. And they, you know, he seems like, and he also wrote up an enormous memo of how to deal with the economy that they weren't interested in passing on to the president. I'm just astounded by that.
Well, I was very surprised by it too, because the president managed to repair his relationship with Hillary Clinton, and yet with Bill Clinton there was a lot of tension, and I have a lot of stories in the book about that relationship. And I think you make a great point that you know, he in some ways he sort of repeated Al Gore's mistake. Now, this is something that from a very early point, Rahm Emanuel, who was still close to Bill Clinton, still is, was just campaigning for him in Chicago a couple weeks ago. Rahm Emanuel was trying to make peace between the president and the former president. He considered it a priority, and it didn't really work. Now, at the end of last year, you remember that Bill Clinton, you know, stood there giving a press conference in the White House press room when President Obama, you know, left and let him do that, and they just had a long meeting. So I think the relationship is a little bit better. We don't know how much better because nobody else was in the room with them that day, but at least they're talking more often now. But the way the White House staff treated the former president, I found striking, and I charted that in the book. For the first 3 months of the Obama administration, he didn't exchange a single word with Bill Clinton, who was, you know, the only ex-president who he really could learn much from. But there was just a lot of bad blood left over from 2008.
And Jonathan Alden, what is the explanation, though, for the big failure in the so-called shellacking that the president talked about in the 2010 midterms? I mean, one of the things you point out is that in 2008, 130 million people voted. In 2010, it was closer to 75 million. So it's almost half the people didn't vote. Whose failure is that? Because, you know, it seems to me in this country you have these two parties. One of them doesn't have a natural majority, but they're very good at getting their people out to vote. And the other one that has a natural majority quite often doesn't inspire their people to vote.
Well, I'm really glad that you focused on that figure, because to me that's the most important statistic from the election, is that it's not really quite right to compare 2008 and 2010, because there were 55 million fewer voters in 2010. So when the Republicans talk about they have this mandate, you know, from 2010, I don't think they do. But there's always a drop-off in midterm elections, and it's not as steep as that all the time, but there's always some kind of a very, very significant drop-off, because a lot of what are called low-information voters, if the presidency is not on the line, they don't really care about their members of Congress and state legislators and that kind of thing, and they're busy with their lives and they don't vote. But it's true that there was an enthusiasm gap and that the conservatives had a lot of momentum and enthusiasm, and they ran a better campaign. The Democrats never really mobilized the 13 million Obama supporters who had been part of their network in 2008, what was called originally Obama for America and then Organizing for America, OFA, which is finally now getting into gear, but very late. And they just did not do a good enough job of getting their people out in most states. And they did not do a good job of crafting a message that people could really understand. And they offer a lot of excuses for that, that the BP oil spill prevented them from pivoting to the economy for the whole summer of 2010, and the economy didn't get as didn't improve as much as they expected because of the Greek debt crisis, and then the crisis and spread to the rest of Europe. But those are rationalizations, and they basically didn't get it done in 2010 until the end of the year, when the president, I think, began focusing better on the political challenge in front of him. He got the message that he had to figure out how to get independence back and focus on the politics. I think for a long time he thought, I'll focus on the substance and let the politics take care of themselves. And he realized that that was a bit naive.
Heavens forbid that you should govern and not campaign, right?
Right, that's right.
So let me get just though in the last minute, because there's a lot of territory that we won't be able to cover, but just to deal with the State of the Union and the campaign, because in effect it seems like tomorrow night's speech may well be an opening shot in the campaign. And you say towards the end of the new epilogue in The Promise, Jonathan Alter, that the president has got to combat the Obama hate machine, the Fox News and the right wing, the Tea Party and all that stuff. And you don't know whether that 2010 is a prelude for a full conservative takeover of the United States, or merely a mid-course correction. So just address that in the last minute, if you will.
Well, I think this is what's going to be so fascinating about the next couple of years, is that, this is a true battle over what our government is for. And the president's going to lay out a mission that is a couple hundred years old of what in the 19th century we called internal improvements, that we need to invest in our country to be great again. And the Republicans basically at this point only believe in two things: tax cuts and reducing the deficit. They don't have a vision of
that, and they're, of course, mutually exclusive too.
And so that's right; they are mutually exclusive. This is both a substantive fight for what kind of country we live in, and also a knife fight. I know we're not supposed to use those violent metaphors anymore, but this is going to be a street fight, not at the presidential level, but on down the line, because there's an awful lot at stake in 2012. And what I try to do in The Promise is just give folks the background so that they can understand ongoing events with a little bit more historical perspective.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Jonathan Alter.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. And hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I've been speaking with Jonathan Alter, who's a senior editor at Newsweek and an analyst for NBC News. He's the author of The Defining Moment, FDR's 100 Days and the Triumph of Hope, Between the Lines, A View Inside American Politics, People and Culture, and most recently, The Promise, President Obama Year One, just out in paperback with a new epilogue. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the bombing in Moscow.